Welcome to This Week in Dystopia. I'm your host, Christopher Robichaud. I'm a senior lecturer in ethics and public policy here at the Kennedy School of Government.
So Watchmen, one of the most unafraid shows I've seen for really engaging that American trifecta of white supremacy, politics, and economics, and censoring black honor and nobility.
This is season three, and we are going to continue a theme that we began last week by exploring some really cool ways that comic book stories can teach us some things about politics and the political moment that we are in. Joining us today is Chris LeBron. Chris LeBron is an associate professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins. He specializes in political philosophy, social theory, the philosophy of race, and democratic ethics. You might remember Chris from season two of the show, where he joined us to talk about the Grammys and the intersection of music and politics. If you haven't, go back and take a listen to that episode called This Is America to hear Chris's take on Donald Glover, Kanye West, Afrofuturism, and more. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Christopher. It's a real pleasure to be back on.
I'm really excited about our conversation today, and I want to begin just by telling listeners that there's going to be a bunch of spoilers coming your way. If you haven't watched the show that we're going to be talking about, stop immediately. Curl up on your couch. Binge. And then come back and give it a listen. We're going to be talking about Watchmen, the television series today, an absolute masterpiece that premiered on HBO late last year, 2019, but still getting a lot of hits as people are discovering it. Chris, I want to start with, you know, a couple years ago, you penned what would become the most read article from the Boston Review in 2018, where you looked at the movie The Black Panther and you stepped back from it and said, this just isn't the movie that we need right now. And so maybe a good way to start is Watchmen the television series we need right now? Does it do what Black Panther failed to do?
So no, that's a really, really great starting question. So the short answer is Watchmen absolutely is the show that we deserve where Black Panther wasn't. And just so people have some context, you know, my criticism of Black Panther at the core was that it basically traded on the trope of the dangerous Black American male, his body being sacrificed by a kind of black respectability politics that was easily recognizable, at least from my view, to mainstream white liberals who could recognize in T'Challa a kind of noble blackness and for which Killmonger must be in some sense eliminated in order to kind of preserve T'Challa's honor and to do justice. And I had serious problems with the first Black hero movie having to kill the only black American male so that blackness could be seen as noble. Where Watchmen comes in and Watchmen turns that formula on its head, and it begins the very premise that American blackness already had beauty and honor in it, and that beauty and honor has always been put at risk by white supremacy and American politics and even the capitalist system. And so Watchmen, to get the conversation rolling, is one of the most unafraid shows I've seen for really engaging that American trifecta of white supremacy, politics, and economics, and centering black honor and nobility as the kind of source of America's, if there was a source for American integrity, maybe it's actually in the black tradition and maybe not in our kind of revered tradition, going back from the founding and through basically white supremacy and the owning of slaves and Jim Crow afterwards.
Can you walk us through moments in the show that stand out to you as hitting upon those themes?
So I think it's important for listeners to know, and as you know, Christopher, since we're friends separately, I was very hesitant to watch Watchmen. I actually did not begin watching it the moment it aired. I didn't jump in until maybe episode 6 or 7 had already aired, and I decided to go ahead and give it a go. And for listeners, the reason why I want to flag this is because my experience as a media consumer and a geek of sorts in comic books and video games and board games, that typically the topic of race and white supremacy are usually not handled very well. And to be perfectly frank, I was doubly concerned, being that the show was not being helmed by a black artist. But the show aired, and it was really well respected by people whose opinions I respect. I decided to give it a go. And I want to say that because as I gauge the show, the very first episode, landed like a megaton bomb for me, because right off the bat, we are exposed to the Tulsa race riots of 1921, an area that was known as Black Wall Street. And this scene sets up a kind of dynamic that reverberates throughout the entire season, wherein the rage of whites just by the mere presence of blacks and black folks doing well, which is why the area is called Black Wall Street, was actually one of the most prosperous black neighborhoods in all of America at the time, was almost enough on its own to warrant a part of the riot. That isn't the whole story of the riot, but a lot of it had to do with certain kind of racial resentment that can boil over on the part of whites vis-a-vis this black community. And of course, the outcome isn't that they're simply asked to leave, but it is literally a massacre where hundreds died. And out of this, we get a survivor. And we will speak about this a little later, Chris, I'm sure, but there's an early kind of callback to the Superman mythos where a young boy is cast from his burning world into a world that's foreign to him, and he must make his way. And this initial kernel is what gives Watchmen its incredible moral gravity.
I think that's a great observation, and maybe it's an invitation to just continue with this theme, because to me, I shared your reservations. I came at it from the standpoint that Watchmen as a comic book in the mid-80s was transformative. It was transformative to me. It was a transformative story for so many people. And I could only imagine the many ways that any sequel would screw it up, let alone one that tried to touch on these issues. But like you, I've been blown away with it. I jumped in right away, but I was absolutely blown away. But this origin story, we get an amazing twist in the sequel to Watchmen. I say twist only because it plays off of what were common expectations, and that we get the origin story of Hooded Justice, which turns out to be, in this world, the origin story of superheroes. And it's a radically different origin story than the Superman, but also quite similar to the Superman story, which was, in the real world, the first sort of contemporary superhero. So maybe you can speak to Hooded Justice and how important you think that storyline is.
It's absolutely fundamental to the entire story, because what we learn is that this young boy, Will Reeves, but we find out later in the series through Angela. So we should step back, because the main character that we see in the show, Angela, who plays the role of Sister Knight, she's a member of a kind of progressive, or at least a radically different police force in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the mission of which is to fight clan-like groups, in this case the 7th Cavalry, and to fight white supremacy. And through Angela, we get the importance of Will, because Angela is Will's contemporary avatar, not only of justice, but of rage. And so by the time we get to Will, and we figure out what the background is, it's an incredible revelation, because unbeknownst to the viewer, if you haven't seen the show at least one time, the role of Hooded Justice explored through a show internal to the show. The characters in the Watchmen show are actually the show they call Watch Call. I believe it's called American Hero or American Hero Story. And in it, Hooded Justice is shown as this righteous and rogue defender of the good and the right. And but he's portrayed as being white, but he's clearly somewhat revered for being the person who will stand up for that which other people will not, all by himself. But we come to find out in one of the most powerful episodes, I really believe, in maybe all of television, that Hooded Justice is actually a black man, and his whole visage, the person with a hood over his head and the noose around his neck, is actually a symbol of his kind of vengeance justice, whereas the noose is a holdover from Will, who is a cop in the show before he becomes Hooded Justice, is lynched by fellow police officers for trying to fight this white supremacist group. And he's cut down, and he's left with only the noose. And the rage in him builds to such a degree that he begins fighting crime and realizes he can do this, especially if he takes on a secret identity, which he does, which is that of Hooded Justice. But the great irony is that Will, as Hooded Justice, is revered as a first hero and is assumed to be white, except by the white leader of a group who actually wants Will to hide his black identity from the rest of the group, and also refuses to take on any racial justice of his own. But the really important point here is that we get to Angela through Will, because she is an inheritor of The Rage and the episode, episode six in particular, where she actually lives his memories. It's an extremely powerful metaphor for the trope of Black anger, because a common political question is, why are Black people so angry? And this episode captures a certain kind of patrimony, affective patrimony, where Will's anger becomes Angela's, and it was hers before she even knew it was hers to have, just by virtue that there could be such a thing as white supremacy. But then she really learns it's for all intents and purposes in her blood, desire and anger to fight those who want to exclude you from society merely because of the color of your skin.
I want to continue with this theme from a different direction, which is, we're spoilers away at this point, folks, if you haven't noticed.
Yeah, right.
But
right,
you know, right. As it becomes clear, focusing on, you know, on Angela for a moment, as we learn as the show progresses, is that partly this is about her romance with Dr. Manhattan. And
oh, yeah, sure.
Dr. Manhattan is hiding, as it were, as her partner, and then as the show progresses, is revealed as Dr. Manhattan. But this is sort of a meta point, but I feel it picks up this theme in a way with Hooded Justice and with Angelo's Sister Knight. What do you think? And there, I don't know. I haven't thought about this enough, so I'm really looking to you for some guidance. What do you think of the fact that producers could have, once Dr. Manhattan was revealed, cast someone who reflected the kind of Dr. Manhattan that we saw in the film? Instead, they cast an actor of color as Dr. Manhattan. They kept that actor as Dr. Manhattan. That's not nothing, is it? That's significant, do you think?
Absolutely is. And it's really important, because this matters for what I'm about to say about Dr. Manhattan. You know, part of the show revolves around the crux of two centers of historical white authority and power being transformed, one being the police, which I guess we could talk about separately, but it's already been mentioned. But the second powerful symbol of white authority in America has been that of the white male body, the straight white male body. And for listeners who aren't fully familiar with the important thing about the Watchmen is that they're not a super-powered group, with the exception of Dr. Manhattan, who is quite literally the most powerful being ever, nearing the status of a god. And so what Chris is referring to is that Dr. Manhattan is constantly being referred to in the show as this being who is kind of beyond the reach of human access and comprehension. He turned the tide of Vietnam by himself by merely walking the land and zapping away, you know, Vietnamese, Viet Cong tanks and artillery. But he's disappeared and he's left us. But we get in episode 8, it's revealed to us that Dr. Manhattan has actually been on, not, he's been on Earth this whole time, but not only he's only been on Earth this whole time, but he's a Black man married to Angela. And to your question, Chris, about why is this important, I think there are two things here. One, there's this kind of bond that Manhattan represents, where in his own childhood, we get the story of him being a kind of immigrant fleeing from the terror of the Holocaust. And his sensitivities to owing, right, by way of the contract he somewhat binds, he engages with the people who help give him refuge. So you get an early sign this is a person with a sensitivity towards the plight of the oppressed. But nonetheless, he becomes the world's most powerful man. He's extremely intelligent, but he gains these powers through a freak accident, as often happens in comic books. But he's the world's most powerful man, and he's the world's most powerful white man. And this is something that a comic book, as you well know, leaves right where it is. But in this show, the writers have it that Manhattan is fated to fall in love with Angela, who is Sister Knight in the show. And two things happen. He wants to be able to love her, but remember, this is a person who can see across all times. And he knows what will happen in the future. And he knows that, well, he knows two things. One, he's going to give up his memory, and he will know nothing for 10 years. He will live as a mere human with the help of Walter Veit, a device that he gives him to Manhattan to lose all his memory. And he will live as a regular Black man, as Angela's love partner, husband, for 10 years. But when he comes out of this, him having lived in the skin of a Black man was transformative on its own. He doesn't resume the visage of Manhattan as a white man, but as Manhattan as a Black man. And what I think is symbolically important here is something that I often explore in my own work, and that is the role of sympathy and imagination, and what it means to live Black in America. And what the show does is quite literally have this white man live Black in America for 10 years. And it seems that the experience is so become so fundamental to his being that even when he could revert to who he was, he can only get there halfway because he must carry some of that Blackness quite literally with him in his appearance. And I think one of the things the show is aiming for is the idea that if we're to have racial justice in America, it can't merely be through the formality of laws and policies, but that we must get to a place where whites in America actually can try to simulate as best as possible what Manhattan has accomplished. First, the willingness to give up the past that they're attached to that justifies their own story. But then after they've given up that past, they embrace a new future in which the other, in this case Blackness, they're willing to absorb something into their own lives if for no other reason than to be able to move forward together in a way in which the actual differences of skin color and race just merely disappear. And I think this is what the show was aiming for, in having Manhattan not only become Black, but also stay Black to a certain degree.
I'm digesting all that, Chris. It's going to take me like a week. It's great. It's great stuff. I want to turn to the police for a moment. You know, the original Watchmen, as we all know, was in some sense an indictment of the typical superhero tropes. And one of the clear messages was that many of the people who would dress up and wear masks and go out to quote unquote fight crime have real problems. You know, Rorschach has a lot of problems. Vite has a lot of problems. Manhattan's completely disengaged and so forth. And Night Owl is just a rich thrill seeker. And they're all extra legal entities. They all work outside the law. You know, the only one who has any kind of legitimacy has only a completely bankrupt legitimacy. That's the comedian who's working for the federal government to carry out assassinations. And now here comes this new Watchman, and the superheroes, as you noted, don't really have superpowers, but the costume heroes, let's call them that, the costume heroes, Sister Knight and Looking Glass, are cops, and the cops are wearing masks. What is the show asking us to do with this?
I just want to begin by saying it was this aspect that had me the absolutely most concerned about the show. This has happened against the backdrop of Black Lives Matter and the very point that the police, to a very significant degree, can be perceived as the enemy of at least Black people on behalf of the rest of the people of America. And so here comes a show that the police are the heroes and they're wearing masks and they have these, what is this? But it turns out that the police's mandate here it originates. So we have to recall for listeners that this is in Tulsa. So many, many decades earlier, the Tulsa race riot. So white supremacy is still a fact of Tulsa in the show. And then at some point later, I believe the show happens in the 90s, I think, but maybe I'm wrong about that. There is the White Knight, where on Christmas, at midnight on Christmas, the white supremacist group of St. Calvary endeavors to murder all the police. And the result of this, even though we find out that there's actually somewhat part of the plan, but it seems to develop its own kind of legitimacy, the result of this is that the police do two things. One, they find it that it is necessary for them to protect their own identities. And then number two, that their main mission will be to eradicate the 7th Cavalry, which is a white supremacist group, as has been mentioned. And I think what the show wants to get us to do, and I think they do it really well because it's a super delicate topic, is to see that the problem with the police is, one, it's an institutional problem. How you design an institution is how the institution's character will develop. And the police force, as we currently know it, generally speaking, in many cities, has developed the character of a nation that has used the police for the express purpose of suppressing minority groups. But what the Watchmen shows us is that if you rethink the institution itself and its main purpose, you can reform the character of those who partake in it. And so then point number two is that the people who take up the mantle in the police, these are people who are wholeheartedly in for eradicating white supremacy. And so part of what the show seems to want to be saying is, one, if you change the institution, the nature of the institution, you actually can change its moral character and moral mission. And then in doing so, you can actually in some sense retrain or at least reshape the character and moral nature of those who partake in institutions such that that moral nature is aligned with what justice genuinely requires. And for the viewer watching it, one of the things it invited me at least to do was to not give up a criticism of the police today, because I think that's I think they deserve a lot of criticism they receive, but to think about the police as potentially transformative if only we could. But of course, the if only we could ... for us today is an enormous if only we could. But it adds a more nuanced conversation to the idea of either the police should stay as they are or prison abolition or police abolition. Neither of those two are viable options. But this middle option is viable but extremely difficult and requires a certain kind of moral courage. And I really think that was the role of the police in the show, at least their portrayal of it.
Interesting. That's a lot to chew on as well. And that's and I'm very grateful for it, because I've been wrestling too with how to interpret the you know what they're doing with the police in this show. I want to step back and, you know, trying to tie this to the original Watchmen. That story, for me at least, me as a reader, ends on a bit of a bummer, right? And the bummer is, and this is why I think the movie was such a profound failure, even though it was quite beautiful to look at it. I don't think it got this, is that, you know, this comic book comes out, you know, this 12 issue comic book comes out in the mid-80s when there is heightened concern, again, with nuclear annihilation, you know, United States and USSR. And so there was a real panic in the air. Are we gonna do it this time? Are we gonna sort of fulfill the horrible promise of the Cuban Missile Crisis? Are we gonna blow ourselves up? And you know, one of the, to me, sort of sad messages of the original, like bummer of an ending of the original Watchmen. Again, spoiler alert for those who haven't read the original book, is well, you know, Veidt saves the day by killing millions,
right,
and perpetrating
and
perpetrating
right
and perpetrating a massive deception. Like, the only thing that's going to get us from like wiping ourselves out is, you know, complete fear of some other, you know. So you walk away from what, and then Dr. Manhattan is of course willingly part of that by destroying Rorschach, even though his journal gets out. So you walk away from Watchmen going, damn, is that true? Is that what humanity's like? I mean, do we need to be like scared into not blowing ourselves up? So at that level, like, is the takeaway message of this new series as bleak, or is it more hopeful than the original one?
Oh, I certainly think it's more hopeful, and I appreciate your use of another, because one of the things that happens by the end of the show, at least on my view, is, you know, Dr. Manhattan is he sacrifices himself, but at the end there is no other to fear in the show, whereas, as you know, as you mentioned, that at the end of the comic book, you know, it's the thesis seems to be we always have to be afraid of somebody if we're to have it together. So the only way to get over, you know, political strife is to think about, you know, what if aliens came, or we weren't attacked by aliens, and that seems to get us together. But that kind of a solidarity is really fraught, because should it turn out to be the case that there really is no threat, which is why the deception needs to keep on going, then we'll return to business as usual. But what the show promises, it doesn't deliver on it, because we don't know what happens after Manhattan dies, but nevertheless, Sister Knight saves the rest of the day, and Veidt actually helps a bit too. One of the things the show seems to indicate is that the need for fear is over, right? The deception is now eradicated from Veidt, but also white supremacy, at least in the form of the 7th Cavalry, is decisively eradicated in a society that has already claimed to want to move beyond it. And so what the show's thesis seems to be is that it's possible for society to move forward so long as the last vestiges of our false consciousness, if you want to put it that way, of our biases, of our bigotry, if they could be eradicated, it's actually possible we can move forward if there's enough will to. And so in the show, I mean, as you know, President Redford has, you know, been a champion of civil rights and the like, and racial justice. It's only the 7th Cavalry that won't get on board. And so the show seems to suggest that if you can just get past this vestige, then you can maybe get genuine progress. Of course, as a show, it simplifies it, because white supremacy is never in just one group or one evil scheme. But nevertheless, I believe it's a much more hopeful thesis.
So we're going to end with the million or billion dollar question. Is Angela a Sister Knight? Is she all powered up?
So for listeners, there's an inside joke when Dr. Manhattan meets Angela, and Angela says, so can you give someone else your powers? And he says, I suppose. And he says, well, can you put them in this egg? And he says, I suppose I could. Now you fast forward to the end of the show. Manhattan is now destroyed in the course of the evil plot by 7th Cavalry, and Angela's house is attacked. When she goes back to her house, on the floor amidst the wreck of dishes and broken eggs is one egg. And Angela recalls this conversation she had with Manhattan when she first meets him some a decade and some change ago, and she ingests it. And the part of the joke when they meet is she asks, would I be able to walk? Can you walk on water? And he says, sure, I could. So the last scene we get in Watchmen is Angela eats this egg, and she takes off her shoes, and her feet are about to hit the top of her the water in her pool, and that's the end of the show. But it's also important to know
that I screamed out loud when that happened. I was like, you can't cut now.
Yeah, right. I bet you did. So here's my argument. As a good philosopher, I must have evidence. My position is that Angela absolutely becomes the new Dr. Manhattan, Miss Manhattan, just Manhattan. And one reason why I believe we can say that was a few reasons. One, the show had incredible integrity, and it would be almost trifling if they set all that up and turns out she didn't. But we also get the callback and the hint forward where Manhattan, as the 7th Cavalry is about to attack, Angela finds him where? Hovering above the pool. And so I have to believe that at the end, she indeed has his powers.
I also like the message. I don't know. I haven't thought about it enough to read too much into it. But I remember, boy, this is geeking out and going back. I had this old, as a kid growing up, I had this old Godfather 3 poster. Can you believe I'm going here? And and it was like, and on it said, you know, here's Michael Corleone sitting. The Godfather 3 is a terrible movie, of course. But you know, here's Michael Corleone sitting there. On the poster, it says, real power can't be given. It must be taken. And yet, you know, this Watchmen is an inversion of that. There are the 7th Cavalry and others try to take Manhattan's power, and for a variety of reasons, that all blows up in their face. But I agree with you. He gives it, and you know, now there's a whole new universe to be explored with Sister Knight having Manhattan's power.
I wonder if I could ask you a question. Do you believe that they should follow up in the season 2, or do you think the story should be lay where it is?
I love the story laying where it is. I feel I could be open one day to telling another chapter in this universe, but maybe maybe 2 decades from now.
That's right.
You know, part of me, the geek in me that just believes that it'll always be great content would be like, yeah, season two. But I think if I'm remotely analytical, I think that nothing in season two could really do what this did if they immediately follow on its footsteps. That's just too close to the action, you know. I'd want to see things like 30 years down the road. I mean, what do you think?
I mean, I'm in full agreement with you, and if I were to put it in related but slightly different way, I think the power of The Watchmen, when the comic book came out, is that it was a story for its time. And the power of this show is that it's a story for our time. And you can't force those stories. And I think they told it extraordinarily well. And I think when the story ends, it ends. There'll be another time where we'll need the Watchmen to come back into our lives. But I think for now, we're good.
And what better way to end this episode than on that? Chris LeBron, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate being on. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you are welcome. And all I'm going to do now is carve out time so I can binge watch The Watchmen all over again. To our listeners out there, if you have not watched Watchmen, please do take the time. It's well worth it, as I hope our wonderful conversation today convinced you of. And if you've watched it already, watch it again. It certainly merits return visits. Thank you all, and stay tuned for another episode of This Week in Dystopia in a few weeks. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to another episode of This Week in Dystopia. Like what you heard? Don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. Want more information on each episode? Visit our Medium page at This Week in Dystopia. To stay in touch with us during the week, follow us on Twitter at Week in Dystopia, and like us on Facebook. Have ideas for future episodes? Want to share your thoughts? Tweet at us or send us a message. We want to hear from you. This podcast is brought to you by the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation at the Harvard Kennedy School.